Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're here again to, you know, cut through the noise and really try to understand the big ideas shaping our world. And today we're tackling something I think a lot of you might be feeling. This sense that, well, that something really basic, something deeply human seems to be missing from global leadership, from how countries deal with each other. You just scroll through the news, right? And you see the conflicts, the climate warnings getting louder, these persistent economic problems. And then there's AI moving so fast, it's kind of dizzying, maybe even scary. And it's hard not to feel like the old ways, the traditional diplomacy playbook, it's not working anymore. It's fallen short. The materials we're looking at today, actually sent in by one of our listeners, make exactly this point. They argue that diplomacy, as we know it, hasn't really grappled effectively with these huge linked up challenges. So that really makes you ask, doesn't it? What if there's another way? Could we actually rethink how leaders, how nations connect and make decisions? Today, we're diving into a concept that tries to do just that. Awakened diplomacy. And this isn't just, you know, a fancy new term. It's put forward as a really vital, urgent new perspective, a whole different framework. Our deep dive today is based on materials from Sandeep Mehra, who's known as the global pioneer of awakened leadership. So our mission really is to unpack this idea. What are its core principles? Why is it being called the next frontier for humanity? How does it propose moving beyond those old power games that just seem to leave us stuck?
And that idea of moving beyond, you know, the usual power dynamics, that's absolutely key here. Awakened diplomacy, it isn't just some theory cooked up in isolation. It's fundamentally an extension of Sandeep Mehra's work on awakened leadership. You can think of it as taking those core ideas, leadership based on inner clarity, on real purpose, on genuinely caring about human well-being, and applying them to the really messy, complex world of international relations. And Mehra's goal here, it's ambitious, no doubt. It's about restoring purpose to power and humanity to governance. That phrase really hits home, doesn't it? Because it speaks directly to that feeling of frustration, maybe even anxiety that so many of us have with how things are run now. So this isn't just theory for us to talk about. The source material frames it as a practical approach, something needed now to solve problems that affect you, your life, our collective future. The stakes, as the materials really stress, are incredibly high. It's about our shared path forward.
Absolutely. And framing it with those high stakes brings us right to our first big area, the crisis of conventional diplomacy and the call for awakening. We really need to start, I think, by looking honestly at where we are now and crucially why we're here. And the source material, wow, it doesn't pull any punches right from the start. It really focuses on the fading efficacy of old diplomacy. It calls traditional diplomacy transactional, like it's just become about power games. Mm-hmm. And this phrase really stood out to me. Compromise without clarity, leading to agreements without awakening. Compromise without clarity. What does that really mean in practice? It sounds like we're just aiming to get a deal, any deal, maybe to save face, instead of making sure it's built on truth, on real understanding of what's actually going on. It's like agreeing to split a pie without checking if it's okay inside.
Exactly. And the real danger, the trap of that kind of compromise, it isn't just kicking the can down the road. It's actually worse. It creates this kind of collective illusion. We pretend we've solved something, right? We celebrate the agreement. But because we've dodged the hard truths, the uncomfortable bits, we've actually built something really unstable. We paper over the cracks, ignore the ethics, ignore the human cost. And that doesn't just make future solutions harder. It destroys trust. Because everyone kind of knows deep down that the peace is fragile, maybe even based on a lie, or at least not the whole truth. So the core idea here is that sometimes an agreement based on avoiding clarity can be more harmful than no agreement at all. The real problems just fester underneath.
And when those solutions are just superficial, when they don't get to the root cause, yeah, they just push the problem further down the line. It creates this cycle of frustration, and often the same problems just pop up again, sometimes even worse. The source is really direct here. It says, old diplomacy has failed us in wars, in climate agreements, in economic systems, and it is failing again in technology governance. And when you watch the news or just think about the big global issues that never seem to go away, does that pattern sound familiar to you? If you follow international talks, you've probably seen moments where a deal felt, well, it felt less like a real solution and more like just postponing the difficult conversation. This perspective argues that feeling, that unease, is right. It's because the whole approach might be flawed at its core, a systemic issue.
It's a really stark assessment, and it leads straight into the source's next point, that humanity is at a threshold. The materials argue we're at this absolute pivotal moment, this point where old diplomacy no longer serves. The sheer scale and complexity of what we're facing now, you mentioned wars, climate, AI, just demands something much, much deeper, something beyond the usual negotiation tactics and carefully worded statements. And the implication is clear. Diplomacy without awakening has failed us. When you really think about concepts like power without purpose or leadership without awakening, you start to see why the current system keeps stumbling. It suggests leaders, countries, institutions, they're often operating without this foundational compass pointing towards collective human well-being. Now, power, national interest, organizational goals, they become ends in themselves, detached from a broader responsibility to humanity. It creates this kind of moral vacuum. And if this old way, this transactional power without purpose approach keeps going, the source implies really serious risks for global stability, for human well-being. It asks, very directly, can humanity actually survive and thrive facing these challenges without a fundamental shift in consciousness? It's not just about managing problems better. It's about our future existence, our ability to flourish, the kind of world we leave behind. The real insight seems to be that our survival isn't just about tech fixes or economic growth. It's deeply tied to a more conscious, purposeful way of governing ourselves and interacting globally. We've been trying to solve human problems as if they were purely technical problems. And maybe that's exactly where we've gone wrong.
And that's precisely the opening for awakened diplomacy. It's presented as the answer, the necessary response to this crisis. Not just a small tweak, but a real evolution of diplomacy rooted in awakened leadership. And the materials are careful to link it back to Sandeep Mehra's foundational work as the global pioneer of awakened leadership. It shows how awakened diplomacy grows naturally out of that. It's not separate. It's like the operational arm of that bigger vision for how leadership needs to change. At its absolute core, the goal is huge. To restore purpose to power and humanity to governance. To explicitly put humanity and human values first. Always, in every decision, every negotiation, every policy. It's not about just fiddling with the current system. It's about fundamentally changing its direction, its moral compass. Can you imagine? If every diplomatic talk, every global policy meeting, every leader's decision started with that one question. Does this serve humanity and honor human values above all? That's the kind of massive shift awakened diplomacy is talking about. It's about recentering power around its true point, human well-being. And honestly, given the challenges we face, it starts to feel less like idealism and more like, well, like a necessity for survival.
Which brings us right to the next logical question. Okay, what makes awakened diplomacy fundamentally different? It's one thing to critique the old ways, right? But what does the alternative actually look like? What are the concrete differences? Let's get into those specifics. To really see what makes awakened diplomacy distinct, we have to first contrast it with traditional diplomacy's mechanisms, at least as the source describes them. The materials highlight a few key characteristics it wants to move beyond. First, this ingrained nation-first, not humanity-first mindset. And that's not just about loving your country. It means power is used mainly for one nation's political or economic gain, often thinking if they win, someone else has to lose. Like a zero-sum game. When every country is primarily looking out for number one, even if number one means short-term gains, it just naturally creates competition, suspicion. It makes it incredibly hard to work together on massive shared problems like climate change or pandemics, which obviously don't care about borders. The built-in limitation is seeing global challenges as just contests between nations instead of shared responsibilities needing shared solutions. Second, there's that compromise without clarity we talked about. This is where the truth gets talk. Well, it gets softened or hidden or ignored just to get an agreement signed. Maybe to avoid conflict right now or just for political expediency. Think about those long climate talks where the hard science gets watered down or deep disagreements about who's responsible get glossed over just to hit a deadline and announce a deal. It might give a temporary break or a good headline, but it doesn't fix the real issue. It damages trust not just between countries, but with the public who can often see it superficial. And it almost guarantees the problem will come back, maybe even worse. The real price of compromise without clarity is sacrificing actual progress for a temporary political win. And third, traditional diplomacy is often described as deeply reactive, not visionary. It tends to jump in after a crisis hits a war, an economic crash, a famine, or when resources become scarce. It doesn't proactively prevent these things through wisdom and foresight. It's always playing catch-up, always putting out fires instead of building a more fireproof future. This reactive mode means energy, money, political focus. It's all constantly sucked into managing emergencies. There's little left for long-term thinking, prevention, or truly changing things for the better. So the limits of these old ways are pretty clear, according to this view. They breed distrust, because everyone suspects self-interest. They lead to instability, because root causes get ignored. And they produce agreements that are often weak, temporary, easily broken, because they lack that deep foundation of truth, clarity, and shared purpose. It's a cycle of crisis management that never quite gets to resolution.
Okay, so if that's the cycle we're trying to break, what are we moving towards? What are those positive, proactive principles that really define awakened diplomacy? The source calls these the pillars of awakened diplomacy's distinctiveness. Let's unpack them. First, and this one feels really important, speaking truth without humiliation or destruction. Now, this isn't about shying away from hard truths, not at all. It's about realizing that how you deliver truth makes all the difference. Does it land in a way that can be heard and maybe acted on? Or does it just make the other side defensive and shut down? Think about the difference between, say, publicly blasting another country versus a quiet, evidence-based conversation behind closed doors, maybe even offering help. It's about separating the clear facts from your own ego or feeling morally superior, making sure the message is about finding a solution, not just proving someone wrong. Second principle, bridging divides without silencing clarity. So yes, bring people together, encourage dialogue, but not by pretending differences don't exist just to have a superficial sense of unity. Clarity, the source insists, is key. Real bridges aren't built on illusions or denial. They need a clear understanding of the ground underneath, including the gaps. So it means talking openly about disagreements, not sweeping them under the rug for the sake of getting along, which usually just leads to a fake peace anyway. Third, awakened diplomacy involves celebrating what is good while courageously naming what is broken. Heh, I like this balance. It's not all doom and gloom, but it's not naive optimism either. It means acknowledging progress where it happens, recognizing good intentions, celebrating collaboration, but also having the courage, the moral strength to call out failures, injustices, and point to what needs fixing. It's a whole picture, which encourages people to engage constructively instead of just getting cynical. And finally, maybe the most critical one, the ultimate test, always bringing leaders, nations, institutions, and even technologies back to the question, does this serve humanity and is it rooted in human values? This one question acts like the main compass, the filter for every single decision. So taken together, these principles try to lift diplomacy beyond just bargaining and deal making. They aim for a space focused on truth, purpose, and humanity. Ambitious. Imagine agreements that feel less like legal contracts and more like genuine commitments to human dignity and our shared future. And you know, think about how applying even one of these might change things in your own life. In a tough conversation, maybe pausing and asking, how can I speak truth without humiliating? How can I connect without ignoring the real issues? It might lead to a very different kind of outcome, right? More lasting, more human. It's really rethinking how we resolve conflict.
And that, how do you actually reflect truth, especially when it's difficult, is captured beautifully in this metaphor, the moon way of leadership. It's a really unique idea from the source material. It explains that reflecting truth and awakened diplomacy isn't always about being relentlessly positive, but it's also not about constant aggressive confrontation either. Instead, it's like the moon. It reflects truth with rhythm, with intention, adapting as light based on the situation. So sometimes you need the full mirror, shining a bright, clear light on the whole picture, no matter how uncomfortable it is. This phase is about total transparency, presenting the undeniable facts, the hard realities, forcing everyone to acknowledge what's really happening. For example, imagine a crisis where a country denies its role. The full mirror could be like a detailed independent report with evidence, satellite images, testimonies making the truth impossible to ignore. No wiggle room. But other times, a gentler reflection is needed. This is about inviting leaders to change course, but without public shaming, giving them space to adjust with dignity. It's a subtle invitation to change. So after that full mirror, maybe, a gentler reflection might be a respected ally having private talks. Not blaming, but maybe pointing out the long-term costs, reputation, economy, morals of staying on the current path. Offering a way out, an off-ramp, so they can change direction without completely losing face. And then sometimes the moon way involves silence. King. Now this isn't giving up or ignoring the problem. It's a deliberate pause. A strategic quietness. It allows the other party space to confront their own issues, their own shadows, to reflect internally without the pressure of constant external demands making them defensive. This can be really powerful. If the gentler reflection doesn't work right away, silence might mean pulling back from loud public statements, maybe quietly shifting international engagement. This pause creates space for internal pressures to build within that nation, for a moral reckoning, or just for the weight of isolation to sink in. It allows leaders to face their own mistakes without the easy excuse of blaming outside pressure. It understands that change has its own rhythm.
And what's really striking is how the source insists this moon way is not weakness. It is awakened leadership itself.
Hmm.
It's about being Absolutely clear on the truth, total committed to it, but being smart and flexible about how you deliver that truth. Adapting to the context, to who you're talking to the timing. It's a really sophisticated way of thinking about communication and influence. Recognizing that just hitting someone over the head with facts doesn't always work. Sometimes a quieter, more rhythmic approach gets you to a deeper, more lasting change.
Yeah, and you can almost feel the resonance of that need for deep, nuanced understanding in the Wounded Child poem the source brings in. The poem talks about forgotten dreams, lost fantasies, a world that's fighting in the bright and talking in the night, often running from the truth. That imagery, it perfectly captures the essence of why that silence phase in the moon way is sometimes necessary. Just like, you know, someone who's been through trauma, a wounded child, needs that safe space to face the past, the pain, the avoided truths before they can heal. The poem suggests humanity as a whole often avoids facing its own collective shadows, the hard truths about war, climate, inaction, injustice. So the Moonway's strategic silence is kind of designed to create that internal space for confrontation, for a self-started healing that maybe outside pressure alone can't force. It's more than just an echo. It's like a diagnosis of what needs healing in us collectively and how it might start. It acknowledges that healing, that change, it takes time, it has a rhythm, it can be difficult. But hopefully it leads to deeper understanding and, like the poem says, helps us rise. This approach gets that real transformation isn't just about policies. It's about facing ourselves, sometimes uncomfortably.
That Moonway approach is really fascinating, deep and nuanced. And it makes you wonder, okay, how does a framework like this actually scale up? Does awakened diplomacy just stay in the realm of foreign ministers and ambassadors? Or does it go further? Which brings us to the expansive reach of awakened diplomacy, because the source is clear. This isn't just for peace treaties. Yeah, the materials definitely emphasize that awakened diplomacy is not confined to foreign ministries, where it truly belongs. Its potential reach is seen as much, much broader than just traditional international relations. It's meant to apply across many critical areas that shape our future. First, think about political governance within countries. Here, awakened diplomacy acts as a call for leaders to put purpose above power. To consciously choose to serve the people, serve humanity over just winning the next election or pushing narrow party agendas that divide us. It asks leaders to look beyond the short-term political game and think about the long-term impact on everyone, globally too. Like, take a debate on immigration. Traditional politics might focus on borders, economics. Awakened diplomacy would push the conversation towards human dignity, shared values, the actual moral purpose of governing, asking, how does this policy truly serve humanity? It changes the whole definition of political success. Then there's global governance. The source explicitly mentions institutions like the UN. Awakened diplomacy aims to pull these vital but often criticized bodies back to why they were created in the first place, uniting nations in shared responsibility, not just competition, and crucially, bringing the broken trust back. The idea is, when institutions like the UN become just stages for power plays or lose their moral focus, they lose their power to actually do good. Awakened diplomacy wants to reinfuse them with purpose. Peace, human rights, collective progress, because trust between nations and between people and these global bodies is absolutely essential for cooperation. Without it, nothing works. And then a really big one, AI governance. The source calls this perhaps the most consequential arena of all. Here, awakened diplomacy is positioned as the conscience in the room, the voice constantly asking, is this technology actually helping humanity evolve? Is it lifting us up? Or could it end up controlling us, making inequalities worse? This is huge, right? Given how fast AI is moving and how much it could change society, awakened diplomacy insists that every AI policy, every new deployment must face that core question. Does this truly serve humanity and honor human values first? It shifts the focus from just, can we build it, to should we, and how do we manage it ethically? And finally, it extends to organizations and institutions everywhere, corporations, nonprofits, you name it, helping leaders look beyond just profit or metrics, grounding their work in human dignity, ethical impact, contributing positively to society. So why is it so critical for this approach to be everywhere? Because as the source keeps hammering home in every single arena, from your local town council to the UN Security Council, it asks that one timeless question, does this serve humanity and honor human values first? That question becomes the universal compass, guiding everything towards a more humane, more purposeful, more sustainable future. It's a total recentering, away from fragmented self-interest towards a holistic, humanity-first view.
And within that broad vision, Sandeep Mehra's role as pioneer is defined very carefully, and I think quite significantly. He says, I do not create policies. I do not draft laws. That work belongs to others. That's a really important distinction. He's not positioning himself as a traditional policy wonk or a lobbyist or a lawmaker. His role is different, deeper, maybe more catalytic. He describes himself as the mirror, the awakener, and the bridge. Let's unpack what those active roles really mean. As a mirror, he's not just reflecting back what leaders say. He's actively showing them the things they don't see, the unacknowledged truths, the forgotten values, the ethical blind spots, forcing a kind of self-confrontation, revealing the uncomfortable stuff that's easier to ignore. As an awakener, his job is to push leaders beyond their usual ways of thinking, their reactive habits, their narrow viewpoints, to prompt a shift in their consciousness, urging them towards a deeper sense of purpose, a wider view of humanity. It's not just giving your info, it's trying to change how they think and what guides them. And as a bridge, he tries to connect groups that seem totally opposed. Not by finding some easy middle ground compromise, but by digging deeper to find a shared commitment to humanity, something they might have buried under politics or ideology. Finding that common human ground that can overcome the surface differences. The source talks about a rare balance in how this is done. Truth delivered with dignity, confrontation paired with vision, criticism coupled with possibility. So it's not just about pointing fingers or tearing things down. It's about doing it respectfully, offering a positive way forward, inspiring something better. It's critique, yes, but constructive critique aimed at elevating the whole conversation and the potential outcomes. Now think about the usual advisors or commentators you see out there. How does this compare? Many criticize, some offer vision. But how many really manage to pair sharp criticism with a truly dignified, hopeful vision and a practical, humanity-first path to get there? This approach feels potentially much more powerful because it aims to elevate and inspire change, not just shame or blame. It tries to create room for real transformation, not just another transaction.
Yeah, that difference between just pointing out what's wrong and actually offering a path forward, one that feels dignified and purposeful, that seems absolutely key. And it brings us into our final section, the urgent need and enduring principles that really hold this whole framework together. And here's a statement from the source that really flips the script on how we usually think about global problems. The root of our crises is not technical, but human. The big things we worry about, wars, climate change, the risks of AI, the source says they are not technical and not merely political. Instead, they're called crises of leadership and of lost human values. That's a huge shift in perspective, right? From looking outside ourselves to looking inside at how we lead and decide. Let's look at the specific examples given. Wars are not caused by lack of resources, but by lack of awakened leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That directly challenges the common idea that fights over land or oil are inevitable. It suggests the deeper problem is a human failure. Leaders unable or unwilling to act with purpose, with empathy, with a vision for everyone. It implies that even with scarce resources, awakened leadership could choose cooperation over conflict. Similarly, climate change is not unsolvable, but unprioritized. That's a bold claim. It basically says we have or could develop the solutions, technically speaking. What's missing is the political will, the unified global purpose, the consistent choice to put the planet's long-term health ahead of short-term economic or national gains. It frames it as a crisis of human values, not just carbon. And this one is crucial. AI is not inherently dangerous, but the governance around it is dangerously unconscious. So the tech itself isn't the problem. It's a tool. The real danger, according to this, is the lack of conscious humanity-first thinking guiding its development, the lack of deep ethical foresight, the reactive rather than proactive governance. That's a serious warning. So in this light, awakened diplomacy is positioned as the missing link that addresses these core failures. It's not about finding new tech or writing more laws. It's about reawakening purpose and shared values right at the heart of leadership and how we interact globally. It's like saying we have powerful tools, but we've kind of forgotten the human instruction manual for using them wisely.
And to provide that guidance, awakened diplomacy stands on the five timeless pillars. These are the core principles, the bedrock, the operating system, if you like, for this whole approach. The first is truth without arrogance. Seems simple, but think about how often truth is used like a weapon today, or dismissed entirely. Awakened diplomacy asks, how do we share difficult truths about environmental damage, human rights issues, past wrongs in a way that allows the other person to actually hear it, reflect, maybe change, without being shamed or attacked? It means carefully separating the facts from our own ego or need to be right, focusing on the shared human consequences, not just winning the argument. That takes real discipline from leaders. Second pillar, purpose above power. Foundational. Every action, every policy must stem from serving humanity and the planet, not just grabbing more power for oneself, one's party, or one's nation. It demands a constant self-check. Why are we doing this? Is it for power or for purpose? It completely reframes what success means. Third, clarity over compromise. We've touched on this. Agreements built on hiding the truth or ignoring core issues just don't last. Real clarity, a shared, honest understanding of the facts, the challenges, the values, is essential. That doesn't mean being inflexible. It means being relentlessly honest about what you're agreeing on and what still needs work. Building on solid ground. Fourth, unity without uniformity. This pillar values the amazing diversity of cultures and viewpoints we have globally. It aims to bring these different voices together to collaborate, but without trying to make everyone the same. Valuing different paths while working towards shared humanity-first goals. True unity here isn't identical thinking. It's converging on purpose while respecting differences. And finally, the fifth pillar, which kind of sums it all up. Human-first governance. Every action, every decision from local to global must ultimately answer, does this preserve and uplift human dignity? Does it prioritize the well-being of people and the planet? These pillars aren't separate ideas. They weave together into a strong framework. Together, they're meant to ensure that decisions consistently move us towards a future that doesn't just avoid disaster, but actively promotes human flourishing and dignity. And it's really interesting how these principles echo the feeling in that Someday poem, also from the source. You know, the poem envisions a future where things might change for better, where we learn to honor what truly matters, remember love above all, where selflessness will trend. The five pillars of awakened diplomacy are basically the how-to guide for making that Someday vision real. They provide the practical moral framework for creating a world where, as the poem hopes, the brain will rest and the heart keep glowing through governance that actually lifts the human spirit. They're the blueprint for achieving that deeper potential.
That's a really great connection. Bring the poetry and the practical pillars together. And it makes it crystal clear that a call to action for all leaders isn't just some lofty ideal. It's presented as urgent, as necessary. Awakened diplomacy isn't just a concept to think about. It's framed as a direct call to action. A challenge to leaders in every field, government, global bodies, AI pioneers, really every leader in every sector, to actively take up this approach. And it asks for a huge shift in how leaders see their own role. Moving away from being controllers of power towards becoming stewards of humanity. That's a fundamental rewrite of leadership, isn't it? From dominance and self-interest to responsibility, care, and service for the good of all. It demands real courage, looking inward, acknowledging that real power might actually lie in nurturing life, not controlling it. Think about what that call means for the leaders you see in the world. Or maybe even more directly, what could it mean in your own life? At work, in your community, family, even just how you interact day to day. What if you consciously adopted that mindset of stewardship instead of control or just looking out for yourself? How might that change things? It's a call to level up our own leadership, however big or small our stages.
Which brings us finally to the legacy and movement itself. If awakened leadership is the inner work, the foundation, then awakened diplomacy is how it shows up in the world, how it gets put into practice. It's described as the way we bridge divides, the way we manage crises, the way we awaken humanity at scale. It's positioned as the practical framework for navigating where we go next. And it's really stressed that this isn't just Sandeep Mehra's project alone. It's meant to be a movement. The source describes its nature in a very unusual way. A soul-born initiative, not a registered NGO, trust, or foundation. That's key. It suggests it's not tied up in typical organizational structures, funding demands, or bureaucracy. Instead, it's called a living, breathing movement of consciousness, founded and guided by Mehra, but standing sovereign, rooted in inner clarity, not external validation. It's explicitly called a conscious mission, an offering from soul to soul, not system to system. This very different, non-institutional approach seems designed to highlight its independence, its organic nature, and its focus on deep, conscious change rather than just tweaking the existing systems. It aims to operate outside the very limitations it critiques. And the closing message is incredibly direct. Without awakened diplomacy, we are left with politics as usual, and politics as usual is no longer enough. That's not just criticism. It's a stark warning and an urgent plea for a totally new way of doing things, a way that reflects the seriousness of our global moment and demands a different kind of leadership if we want not just survive, but truly thrive.
So as we wrap up this deep dive on awakened diplomacy, the main takeaway really seems to be that it's presented as, well, not optional, not just a nice philosophy, but as the most urgent need of our time. The path, the source suggests, where leaders can face truth with dignity, where nations can disagree without war, where institutions can find their humanity again, and where even powerful technology like AI can be guided to serve life. It's called the diplomacy the world has never really practiced, and maybe the diplomacy it now cannot survive without. It really makes you question the fundamentals of how our world is run.
And that really leaves us with a powerful question for you, the listener, to take away and maybe sit with. If the deepest problems we face truly aren't technical, but are rooted in a lack of awakened leadership and lost human values, then what might happen if you consciously tried to embody just one principle of awakened diplomacy? Maybe truth without arrogance in that difficult conversation you need to have, or purpose above power in a choice you make at work. How might your own commitment to just one of these principles in your daily life start to ripple outwards? How might it contribute, even in a small way, to the bigger awakening this movement hopes for? Maybe it's like that invitation in the poem, "This is your home," to find your own quiet space, your own place of divine healing, because ultimately the source suggests it's from that inner clarity, that personal awakening, that truly awakened leadership and perhaps awakened diplomacy can really take root and start to change our world.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.